So the first presentation will be from Sunday. Technology change, if I may, just give a bit of
insight into Saleh prior to its current form being appointed. We were appointed in December.
You don't mind the
No, I'm sorry.
Can you start with the introduction? Okay. Can you start with the introduction? I know that you might come go through this. But it will help me to do that at the very beginning.
Please correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that you would like us to introduce myself and then my colleague Norman.
That's correct.
I am Dr. Ingrid Tuberson. I am the chairperson of Saleh and have been since December 2016. Next to me, I have David Kahoma, who himself is in charge of, at the moment, he is our acting CEO, while the interim CEO is abroad. And he will be doing part of the presentation as well. Next to him, we have the Chief Financial Officer of Saleh, and she is Ms. Letabo. And the Tabo is Manamela. And next to the Tabo is the chair of our Audit and Risk Committee, who is Mr. Kanam Motiawa. So there you have the people who are here from Saleh today.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Chair, we've been through, I can say, a very vigorous time of change since December 2016. And I think it is to our credit that we have just been given our first clear audit for Saleh. And we believe that it is because of us working together and actually becoming more focused on Saleh's actual mandate that we are where we are today. And the other thing is that Saleh, for the first time in its presentation of itself, is you see more of the human factor. The factor which we believe is the reason why Saleh should be working with energy efficiency in the first place. So if we could go through the slides, please. And when David does start speaking, we'll be looking at the way 2016-2017 ABT was drawn up during the time when Saleh had no board for 10 months and the current board came on board in December, and we have worked in the last few months to bring Saleh to the point where he was in office. Are you there?
Yes.
Good. I'm not sure whether everybody knows this, but Saleh has got a specific mandate. And we don't see the bottom section at the moment, but it was interpreted to mean that the Act provides Saleh with a specific mandate of directing, monitoring, and conducting energy research and development to promote energy research and technology innovation, as well as to undertake measures to promote energy efficiency throughout the economy. I find that at our next presentation, I believe, Chair and members, that you will be seeing that Saleh actually is engaging with what its actual mandate is, and the first paragraph of its mandate is energy efficiency, and that is where we are going to. So the Energy Act mandates Saleh to undertake all types of energy research, save for nuclear energy. And of course we've seen that the strategic model is in line with that of science and technology, the DOE and DSC. So that our objective is to focus on applied research. So activities that will actually improve and increase applied research activity, with primary research being undertaken then by the DSC and its agencies and SOCs. I think it is Saleh is in an interesting intersectional position, in that it is almost a conduit but also a collaborator with a number of state agencies. And so of course, more and more we have seen our role in the education on energy efficiency as being vital, so that applied knowledge can be used within our communities. I think at this point it would be good to say that I think if you took over and carried on further, and I will answer questions later if there are any.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of the Committee. The relationship that Flamini has with the department is instinctive. But we also work very closely with the Department of Science and Technology. In the sense that there is a provision in the Act for us to work closely with the Department of Science and Technology. And in fact, there is almost a concurrent mandate on certain issues. The primary focus of the League, of course, is applied research, which is secondary research. And we do take cue from some of the primary research that is undertaken by the Department of Science and Technology. We cannot be complete up until it has got meaning in the work of government and the programs of government. And in that regard, our relationship with the Department of Trade and Industry in terms of moving the concept from applied research, from demonstration into products that can give meaningful impact to the economy. This is how our relationship with the Department of Trade and Industry comes about. We also have a relationship with the Department of Transport, in the sense that most of the work that we do affect the transportation system. Actually, transport cannot work without energy. But transport as it is today is not transport as it should be in the future. And therefore, our work in terms of cleaner transport modes, cleaner transport energy systems, is what we collaborate with the Department of Transport. Energy in its current form has got environmental impacts in the sense that if we continue with fossil fuels as they are right now, we will continue to increase the load of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And if we took the root of the mandate of the land in terms of energy, renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies, and then promoting those effectively. Our work with the Department of Environmental Affairs in terms of various agreements that we have reserved away in terms of our UNFCCC arrangements. The contribution of the Navy in bringing down the levels of greenhouse gases can be greatly enhanced. Our relationship with the Department of Rural Development is to the extent that if one were to look at the progression of energy provision in South Africa, it has to a large extent been grid-based. We have got the electrification program under the Department of Energy, which has done very, very great. But the biggest challenge that we have at this point in time is communities in the deep rural areas who don't have access, where the grid is expensive to reach them, and some of the interventions that we do in terms of developing renewable energy technologies and systems is intended to provide access to energy to rural communities. And I will touch on these issues at a later stage. Most of the work that is done in municipalities, and therefore the work that we do affects some of the mandates of municipalities. So therefore our work with the Department of Cooperative Government, well, DCOG, as it says right now, then enhances the ability of municipalities to execute their own mandates. Maybe, Chair, what I also need to mention is the fact that one of the programs that we have is linked to the Expansion Africa's program. And in this regard, the idea is to look at the green economy and look how the workings of SADC, in particular in rural energy provision, in infrastructure development, in environmental affairs, in social development, can be enhanced. So the working for energy program works very, very closely with the Department of Public Works other expansion type of growth programs to create jobs, to create skills, and to provide basic services. In terms of our vision, we see ourselves as leading the internet solution for low carbon economy in South Africa. And we see our vision as being to accelerate the implementation of energy utilization development, thereby improving energy efficiency and increasing active operational energy for the benefit of South Africa. So all of these issues that I've touched upon are actually embodied in the vision and mission of the organization. In a nutshell, these are the programs, technical programs that are involved in. We are talking about inner coastal wells. In particular, we're talking about carbon capture and storage. And basically, this program, what it does, is looking at the South African economy. It is looking at the resources that we have at this point in time. At this point in time, what we have is coal, and we've got lots and lots of coal. Therefore, carbon capture and storage is looking at an era where we can continue using existing resources that we have, in people, in liquid fuel production, but at the same time dealing with the carbon dioxide that comes out of the system by burying it in the ground. I'm just going to say, burying it, but in principle, the idea is to check the carbon dioxide before it's released into the atmosphere and finding a way in special geological structures and keeping it there and making sure that it doesn't escape. On the smart grid side, smart grid basically is beyond smart meters, as many municipalities may interpret. But it's basically the whole system of making sure that the utilities are able to know what is happening in their systems. They are able to know how to control the energy supply. They are able to link up with other sources of renewable energy provision coming from the system. We are not talking about rooftop PV systems. They are linked to smart grid programs. We are talking about the IDIPT programs. This program is also linked to smart grid programs. So smart grid is basically the future of this distribution. And it's also a provision for a better generation that we will see in the future. Greener mobility, as I said, is to look at transportation. Transportation starting from where we are with the current type of the vehicles that we have. At this point in time, the efficiency of internal combustion engines, we're looking at about 30%, and the rest of the 70% is actually being tested, which also contributes not only to global warming, but also the gas that come out of the current engine system are not good for the environment. And therefore, we're looking at alternative fuels that are cleaner and ultimately look at fuels that are not cleaner, but fuels that are not actually emitting any greenhouse gases. So we will be moving the country towards electric mobility, not only in private vehicles, but also in public systems. So cleaner mobility is looking at all of those areas. Data and knowledge management basically is an enabler for policy development, and we are supporting the department in terms of the programs of energy planning that are being implemented. On the renewable energy side at the bottom, this is basically a program which is looking at all renewable energy programs, and we are talking big systems here, which is solar, wind, waste energy, wave and ocean, and of course all of this together with the Department of Science and Technology, Department of Environmental Affairs, we are looking at how all of this can be have already spoken extensively about, safe to say that it is complementary, sometimes a supplementary program which supplements or complements, you know, what energy systems communities may have. I may just want to give an example of the complementarity of this program to the existing program. Research has shown that when most of the households have got electricity, there was an excitement and euphoria to say that, you know, ultimately the government has delivered and our people are now able to have cleaner energy systems. But what became clear over time is the fact that the consumption of electricity was then noted as either diminishing. Diminishing in the sense that as Eskom gets permission from the minister to increase rates on a year-to-year basis, and in most cases, much above inflation levels, the poor communities find it very, very difficult to afford electricity. And therefore, we still have houses that have been electrified in terms of the electrification program. They can be checked to say government has delivered. But in terms of utilization, we then find that, you know, households still go back to use traditional fuel. So the working for energy program then looks at what else is available in the immediate environment. In some provinces, you have got livestock, and basically we use livestock waste to produce energy as part of waste energy program. In some instances, you have got, you know, food and food waste. We can then use food waste to produce energy in the form of biofuel. In some cases, you've got other programs of government, like for instance, in the Department of Environmental Affairs Working for Water Program, where one program, the particular program is dealing with the clearing of waterways, the clearing of invasive alien species. The Working for Energy Program then looks at what can be done to use less available biomass to produce energy to sustain communities together neighboring. So it is a program which is complementary in the sense that where there is existing energy system, it is able then to provide the alternative energy system, and where there's nothing, we also look at other means of providing the energy services to those communities. Now, when the chairperson of the NERI opened, she spoke about the focus of energy efficiency. Now, energy efficiency cuts across. So whether we're talking about big systems under the renewable energy side, or we're talking about small systems in terms of the renewable energy side, energy conservation, energy safe or efficient use of energy is something that is promoted. So it does not necessarily mean that we'll be focusing in terms of, let's say, renewable energy or in terms of you know, other programs to look at just the industry or the commercial sector. We also have programs for making sure that even households, instead of using a ton of wood per year to provide basic energy services, they can use less with efficient systems. Energy efficiency, the main programs that we have in energy efficiency is promotion, but I think the main programs linked in treasury, national treasury, is the 12L, which is energy efficiency for industry, and then 12I, which is the renewable energy incentives for industry. A lot of work has been done in this regard, and then I will touch on this as we go along. I will then touch on the performance in communication for various programs. Just to step back, the structure of the program is on two main strategic outcomes or strategic outcome goals. We are looking at the resilient, efficient, effective and enabling development of environment and complies with all the necessary requirements. We are looking at the energy innovation, the skills, and we are all working towards migrating towards a less carbon. But key to all of this is sustainability, key key to this is also affordability of the system, because it is one thing to have a system, a roadway system, which nobody can afford it, nobody can use, but worse still, a system which when government has delivered, then it has been difficult to maintain. Because what characterizes most of the cleanup technology interventions is the fact that most of them are not well maintained, and if they are not well maintained, then they ultimately fall into disuse. In terms of programs, we've got three main programs, corporate services, governance and administration, and I'm going to touch on that. And then we also have a program two, which looks at applied research, development, and innovation. And all of the areas of innovative fuels, renewable energy, smart grids, renewable energy, inner mobility, data knowledge management, all under that. Then we have got program three, which then focuses on energy efficiency, but in the main, as I said, focusing primarily on the work under 12L and 12I initiatives. Okay, innovative fuels. The idea here, once again, is to look at how South Africa, as a coal-rich country, can continue to be very well, but still be compliant with the electricity arrangement. There are a number of programs in this regard. So the first one is the pilot carbon dioxide storage project. The progress that we have thus far is that the Zululand Basin, let's just step back and say, you have got both onshore and offshore areas that have been identified for potential storage, mass storage of carbon dioxide into the future. And for demonstration purposes, we have identified on land facilities in the Zululand Basin is one of those that have been identified for exploration. Now, the reason why that particular site is special is that it has got a geology which almost functions like a sponge. So when carbon dioxide is injected inside, it is not rocky, the geology is not rocky, so it almost acts like a sponge. It absorbs the carbon dioxide, and then under pressure and over time, the carbon dioxide is actually absorbed and then trapped into the geological structure, and it will not escape. Well, there are a number of issues pertaining to that that I will not touch on to this, to say that, you know, some of them are contained in the report. Of course, going forward, as a social development institute, then we also need to look at models. So the sedimentary static basin model has been created basically to see how, when some dioxide is injected, it will stay and ultimately dissolve into the rock structure. If one is to look at the space that we're operating in, we have always risk associated. And some of the risks would be a risk of, let's say, carbon dioxide leakage. So if carbon dioxide would leak in any particular area, in particular basin, what you then see is asphyxiation. So basically, anybody and anything which is non-plant will perish. So the risk assessment needs to be done to make sure that when this project or projects of this nature are executed, we are able to touch all the basic systems of risk management, health and safety. Now, some of the work has already been done in terms of geological drilling, and some of the information is actually sitting on the 100 course. Drilling course from the Center for Geological Sciences, and analysis of all of these nodes has already been done in collaboration with the Hanson. To the extent that the carbon capture storage is a novel problem, we still need to have our own proof of concept, and the progression that we have that the business case for continuing CCS has been done. And the reason why that had to be done was the fact that in looking at all the instruments that we had, and especially when the debate around shale gas came about, there was then a need to say, with all the debates that were happening around shale gas development, fracking, and there was then a need for us to reassess whether under those circumstances the continuation of the CCS, because they are almost seen as similar by the public, whether it should be necessary. And on the basis of the information that we have right now, there is still a sub-business case for CCS which continues. Of course, you have for technologies for the appraisal of CO2. Basically, for us as South Africa, the CO2 that we have cut mainly, I mean, that is controlled, mainly from the Eskom plant and also Sasol plant. Now, if we are going to proceed 100%, for instance, with CCS because of business and other things, the issue here is to look at other applications of carbon dioxide. And we know that you've got the food grade carbon dioxide, which is in beverages and so therefore, we may want to find other applications for the use of carbon dioxide. And whether the type of carbon dioxide that we are producing from our plants is something that is going to be suitable. There is also a study to look at the impact of the current or proposed carbon taxes on the air, and whether the instruments that exist right now are such that they will support the CCS industry. The finding is that at this point in time, the tax structure is not producing to large scale applications such as CCS. So maybe this is something that in the following years we will look into. Now, bringing technologies like carbon capture and storage into communities is one is looking at there is a need for communities in which these developments are identified need to be exposed or made aware and educated in terms of the principle and the concept of carbon capture and storage. So a number of engagements in terms of career exports, in terms of community engagement, and workshops and trainings have been done over time. The renewable energy side, as I said, basically this question looks at large-scale renewable energy systems. We actually are touching on a number of resources that are not adequately utilized. And I'll give an example. Every municipality is sitting on landfill waste. Every municipality has got sewage treatment plants. And if one were just to take these two examples, and the fact that we are not harvesting any energy coming out of these facilities in a large scale, the way things stand at this point is that we are actually contributing towards methane emissions by reducing greenhouse gas by not treating the waste, by not harvesting the greenhouse gas or cutting out of those systems. But at the same time, instead of harnessing the energy coming out of this waste and using it for the plants themselves, you basically are recording electricity from Eskom to do the work that could have easily been done through those processes of using the energy that will be recorded. So in this regard, the collaboration with the Department of Health and Technology and others is such that we work on the energy technology research we work on the development of the innovation roadmap and see what else is it that we have that and see what else needs to be done and collaborate with the to make sure that this happens. So we also have a collaboration with other programs, the social programs, basically solar thermal systems, offering that training, and we have got a collaboration with the Australian government, who are the primary partners of the social program. Here in Cape Town, we have the Teratech Air Facility, which is basically a facility to train personnel in the wind industry, because this is where most of the wind industry is going to be based. We also have collaboration with other organizations, the UNIRO, which is funding the Swiss Africa Wind Project under RIP. In West Area, in the Western Cape, we are working on the wind energy program, and we are now at the South African Wind Energy Program or project in phase two, which is mainly funded by Nigeria. On the working wind program, I want to skip this one to say that the number of innovation projects that we have done, where we use the directional approach, basically the energy, water, and food security nexus to make sure that the beneficiaries of these programs derive benefit. Let me just touch on some new projects that these batteries have resulted in. A number of municipalities, and actually even this morning, just someone was on air saying that the reason why they are in financial debt is because of the amount of money owed to them by the municipalities. But if you then go to municipalities will say, we are in the position where we are because of the amount of money that your clients owe us. So is that chain of revenue loss, revenue and collection? Now, the smart grid program, which is a project under the Department of Energy, under taken by the name, had identified a number of municipalities, and basically municipalities which were financial aspects to implement their smart grid programs. Now, in the Naledi municipality under the Karoo, Mumbai, district municipality, with the application of smart grids, revenue losses were reduced actually from 23% to 9%, and that could still be improved. So the application of smart grids actually has got a number of benefits that I've seen out of the smart grid program, and the treasury actually is looking at facilitating the rollout of this program to other municipalities because it's a fair approach. I have touched on the data management part. On the energy efficiency side, under the 12L, a number of projects are currently underway. The performance assessments are done in, we've got 10 projects under performance assessment. Projects where these land studies have been done, there are 33, where the base land studies are in progress, 16 programs that we go through, 43, and programs where certificates have been issued, 32, right? So, all in all, at actual there for the year in question, 102 projects where we will get. At actual I, the approved projects were 32, mathematical counselors and certificate issues were 6, and then the projects we had, which we expected to start during the financial year were 10. So in this regard, we're basically looking at a number of interventions on renewable energy. and this may include amongst others with the root of the sin changes. So, in respect of the year of assessment, some of the challenges that I did experience was in equity funding. We were allocated 34 million from the NGL. And as a result, we had a number of standing human resource challenges, in the sense that most of the posts were on contract basis. And there was actually much room in terms of, you know, training positions and, you know, different organization to the level in which it was supposed to be fully operational. In terms of the salary chapter experience, the pre-school campaign impacted a number of students who were studying at the Tarantino facility, in the sense that, like all the students in the country at that time, they couldn't complete, you know, their training programs. We have got a number of collaborations with the international bodies. We are saving on the International Energy Agency, we are saving on a number of structures. And to the extent that for most of the countries in this period, we didn't have a board, there were a number of challenges in terms of travel organizations, and therefore we could not honor some of the global commitments that we had. Once again, due to some of the governance issues that we had at the time, the delay in the finalization of the CS funding agreement with a subcontinent. Okay, so maybe let me just then hand over to my colleagues to give this other insight and then we send it to the table from there. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't hand over to yourself. It's not just a I will just touch on the first couple of slides and then hand over to my CFO.
we have achieved our first clean audit for financial year in 2017 March. This has an unqualified report with no funding, and over the past 2 years has unqualified audit report with funding. So you know, I think the plans that were put in place by the previous board, we finally just come to see them coming together, and then hopefully we'll maintain it for 2018. So we're working very hard on that. Audit outcomes to get to this point of achieving clean audit done is to focus on root cause identification and development of action plans and holding people accountable to these action plans. We've ensured that we've developed enabling policies and then implemented these and held people accountable again. And we've also just strived to achieve a change in behavior in our staff complement, including continuous training and support to all our staff. We've also implemented consequence management, where we've identified any issues with non-compliance with any policies and procedures, and we've also then implemented continuous monitoring and reporting at board level, at expo level, as well as staff level. The next slide is just a summary dashboard reported from the AG that we get as part of our annual audit. And the main focus areas from this that we have decided on for this year and major report just to put a close eye on is our IT governance and system control. And that's something that we are working on and we want very, very closely.
I'm just going to now look at the numbers, what is the thing with the financial position. The thing with the financial position, if you take a look, we have got that to 2 million, and that's basically our requirement. And if you look at the composition of that, we are maintaining like basically made up of non-current assets and also our current assets. But if you look at our current assets, are about 2 million, and that's basically spend a lot of our money on research, and yeah, currently we know that research is not in care tonight, so it goes to the financial performance. On the current assets, we have receivables, we have a rent. This is still not an issue from where we went, we were actually to, but the entity that we were able to go start, so we just still waiting for the funds. And then we also have cash and cash equivalents, that's basically money market investments and cash. But if you look at our total assets, the cash in the bank is basically our main assets. If you move on to the next slide, you see that our current assets are only 1%, the total assets, and then 99% of that is current assets, and we need, like I said, the cash in the bank. For this past financial year, what do we have to be able to do? Was to leverage the funding that we have. So like for every 1 rand that we have from the National Treasury, we have been able to get 6 rand from our local partners to be able to implement the project. So cash in the bank is very important for us because that is what we use. Like the asset that we use to actually get donors, to get other national governments and partners and municipalities to come on board and co-fund what we would like to do. The other thing I would like to highlight as well with the cash that we have in the bank is that we have spent everything that we receive from the National Treasury. So what you see in our cash balance is that I have said donor funds and also like earmark funds for the financial year. So these projects, if I can highlight, Mr. Mahuma spoke about the carbon capture and storage project. We are currently in the process of completing an agreement with the World Bank for about 500 million funding for this pilot project, and that financing agreement is currently going through the process of approval by the State Department for the use of funding. bulk of that balance, and the rest is like your normal trade payables and provisions and non-provisions, mainly related to like government expenses and also loans and like fees and so forth. So basically, our total licensing fee went down by 21%. And the main focus is looking at our financial condition and looking at our licensing. The unspent conditional grant policy, because that is the money we receive from donors to be able to implement our project. So you will see that there's a decline from the last year, and that's basically indicating that even though, yes, we've been able to leverage the funding that we got from government, get an additional plan to implement the project, we basically had a significant decline in cash on donors. Pre-engagement with most of the people of the organization that actually others deal with the donors and engage with the donors on a daily basis. I think what is happening, what we picked up, is that donors are actually focusing away from investment. Funding programs in South Africa, because they are starting to look at us as a more developed country, so they're starting to look at other countries that are less developed than South Africa. So that's why we are really challenging in terms of getting back in to co-fund some of the projects. And as well as most of our projects, they run in phases. So phase one will be like completed in the space of 12 months, and then obviously as you implement the new, you are reaching the completion of that particular project, you start to get less and less money. And most of the time, you will not get money to start a new project from donors up until you have completed and reported on the next project. So I think for the previous financial year, that's where we found ourselves in terms of the funding and the organization. Okay, that's just a picture of our current liabilities, what we have. Okay, on the accumulated surpluses, I think it's important also to highlight this, because a lot of people, when we look at the financial trading, a lot of accumulated surpluses. So we just want to make it clear that the retained surpluses are actually committed. They are also part of the core funding that we are bringing in order to get the World Bank to invest this $500 million towards the ILOT project. So this 186 that you see there, committed. So as soon as we sign the financial agreement, then we'll start spending that money towards that project. Okay, on the statement of financial performance, in our statement of financial performance, what you will not see is the money that we receive from donors, is the money that we, what you will see remains the money that we receive from government, because that goes straight to the statement of financial performance. But the money that we receive from donors will be deferred and we spend that money that will come into the financial performance. So for this year, our total revenue was 84 million, that is what we reported on. And I just want to highlight as well that we are realizing the challenges that we have in terms of finding some of the projects. So we are starting to actually partner with some of our donor entities, and we are actually doing work or bidding for work where we are able to charge the management fee for the work that we do, or to cover the actual hours that people spend on this project. So that's basically the reason for the increase in the revenue from exchange transactions. So we actually focus more on making sure that in partnership with the donors, whenever we are carrying out a project, we're able to charge the management fee, or also able to recover hours that we spend on the project. On the statement of financial performance, on the expenditure side, employee costs remain a significant expenditure for us. A lot of the work that we do requires people being involved in the research work that we do. There's been like an overall conversion for figures here, an 11% increase, and that made up of one increase in the salary for the cost of team adjustment. And then also we've had new people appointed to the financial year for the pilot project. And then on the project cost, if you look at the previous financial year, we had about 5 to 9 million, and now it's 1.4 million. It goes back to what I said about we implement finalize the project, it is important, and that's when you can see new money coming in, and you will just be implemented in an agency stage. On the operating expenses, I also would like to highlight that we spend significantly less than what we had in the previous year, and that is because we had to go back and look at our expenditure and identify what is essential, what is not essential, what can we cut. Because of the more we can cut the operating expenses, the more money we will have to be raised in the moment in the operation. And basically, the slide is explaining exactly what I said, and I just want to highlight that, for example, on the employee cost side, we have about 70% of the employee cost going towards our safety cost, and then the 50% is actually going more towards the support. Okay, and then on the special disclosures that we already have in our presentation, the need of the index culture and the research culture, we need to see that we had a 100% reduction in the index culture and 0% research in terms of the culture here. And that is basically like Mr. Ciela has already said, the improvement in our control environment and continuous monitoring, continuous reporting, continuous engagement with our staff education to make sure that we collectively as an organization strive to achieve an improved control environment and operating model for the financial. Hopefully we can implement this, of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Internally
to address the problems that were there when the board came in. For example, our human resources issues, where we've had employment processes, for example, that would never have passed muster if it had to end up in the labour court, for example. But I think Fanedi, especially in terms of, deserves to be given credit for coming on board, working with the board itself to get all its compliance policies in place, to get its actual labour relations procedures in place. And it's not been easy. I mean, we are sitting here today, and these are probably three, and I'd like to count myself amongst them, are probably the hardest working people in order to get family to where we want it to be. So we would just like you to also bear that in mind when we are being spoken of elsewhere. People have tried really hard, and they've worked really hard, and they deserve credit for it.
Thank you. No, she's the last one. Honourable Mankai, start.
Sorry,
I thought that you were radical. Focused
state-owned entity, specifically in Nigeria. There's nothing in the CV that qualifies us as Turkey in terms of energy. So Chair, those questions have been answered in relation to Mr. Asa's appointment. Chair, as relates to the actual work of CNED, I must express my concern, the ongoing concern around the work that CNED is putting into the carbon storage program and project. For a number of particular reasons, Chair, CNED has itself today admitted that the program itself in terms of the tax structure that has been suggested by National Treasury in relation to carbon emissions means that there is an unworkable case for carbon storage in South Africa, and that's contained in this slide. Therefore, the proof of concept is clearly that the concept does not work and cannot work. And Chair, we also reflect on the UK experience when carbon storage has also not taken off, considering the high expenses, the lack of private sector participation, the fact that the changes in the renewable sector mean that the updates to battery storage will mean that this technology will probably be outdated before they represent a massive cost. And fundamentally, the Navy seems to be going down a rabbit hole that fundamentally is not in the best interest of the state or in terms of South African people, and should rather be focusing on its other line items that we're considering, that this is a very expensive potential white that the state cannot afford. For example, Chair, what is the impact of the carbon storage on the long-term electricity price cost in South Africa? What kind of studies have been done in relation to that? Because carbon storage has an associated cost that places upward pressure on electricity prices, upward pressure on electricity prices undermine long-term economic growth, jobs, development, etc., etc. So, you know, we can't deal with carbon storage itself is not that a project that is cut emissions, that's a cost effectively, and has a long-term cost reduction on the cost of electricity. Chair, you will recall that the CSIR report that was presented to us at the end of last year clearly indicated that South Africa could meet its carbon reduction emission targets without the use of carbon storage. By just developing a closer strategy around utilizing gas and renewables, so why exactly are we pursuing the CCS program, which is costly, expensive, the proof of the test case doesn't seem to work, and we must fundamentally question the wisdom of the specific program. Chair, could the Senate also please indicate for us what participation it has had in feeding into the IRP, considering that it does have a planning component to the work that it does. We'd like to understand how that has interfaced with the department and whether the department has actually used some of its research, specifically because we know that they're pretty, so the near image, they're pretty strong. And just again, this ACE investigation regarding the specific red flag, and we'd like some information on that. Much as we can get at this point. Thank you.
Well, I'll just do that.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start with the head of my lines on 5-9. Clean and fossil fuel. 89% of this country's energy derives from, or primary energy derives from fossil fuel. And we emit about 400,000 tons every year. Now this is a big problem for all of us, and it's been coming a long way. I think in 2010, when it's in Peterson, when starting Mary, she said she's looking for expertise and for ways to better the energy needs of this country. Nothing has really happened with carbon CO2 reporters. It seems so much so that the delaying is like just justifying the continued use of fossil fuels. Then there's also the cost to capture, and any plant that you want to capture the CO2 emissions, that's going to cost the taxpayers an additional 10 to 11 billion rand just for the equipment to capture. And this phase is just a big loss. Then we're not even talking about a pipeline. The pipeline has never been established what pipeline can, if there is a leak, God forbid, compressed, concentrated, and surge into the atmosphere, and there will be way. There's no way that a site will be found right next to a plant, so there will be pipelines. And most pipelines have got a lifespan of about 20 years. So we're looking at enormous cost of it. I don't know how Mr. Peterson at his time said that the Navy will not be a statutory body and it will not make decisions. I'm looking at them for experience and innovation. But, you know, the mandate must still be to promote energy efficiency. Page 11, renewable energy. If you want to promote energy efficiency on this department's budget, we only spend 83 million rand of a budget, a projected budget of 450 million rand, and 82% underspending. How do we assert the market energy efficiency? Page 14, smart grid. Can you decide, or can we say that we can provide access to the grid for IPP? I don't know. Although transmission access was included in the IRP update, nothing has changed, and grid planning cannot be an afterthought. This is exactly what's happening. And we may, on smart grids, we may have the technology to enable municipalities maybe to update the age grid. But now we have the expertise and the necessary policy clarity and the standards to work on. Taxes, incentives. What is the real relevance of 12L? What is it really? It's so cumbersome. Is it really worth the effort to come to it? No, really. In a nutshell, 12L is providing you with 17.5 cents kilowatt hour for each kilowatt hour saved for 12 months. Is it not the right amount of saved? This is a very worthless to the company. Financial statement also doesn't really I'm not really using my government. This is one thing that worries me on one place and one number. Statements on financial statements. This page here. It doesn't say in the top the previous page, say 2017-16, but I think this is more a projected, an actual, and then the variance. It's very unhealthy. If you do traditional budget where you look at the last 3 years when most budgets are done, or you do a zero-based budget and this wasn't been done on this, but you have 317%, 100%, 70%, 64%, 288% variance. That's not healthy on any budget or on any financial statement. It's not actually acceptable to any financial institution. Thank you.
Yeah. this program had the 9 performance target. Of these, 6 were not met, and we also have a resistance to all these targets. There are a number of targets that are given on the report here, but they are not met. What are the reasons behind it? You are not meeting the targets because you have set up these targets for yourself. The other one, Chair, the Sanevi has developed 16 human resource policies, while the other 6 are being finalized. Did the Institute not have human resource policies? Why so many policies? What are the policies about? The last one, Chair, I want to check with Naledi, Sanedi. Naledi, Sanedi, the same person. That goes to the what is the aim of the stakeholder feedback and how is it done? Such as who is the target audience? Thank you, Chair.
Now, Mr. Yes,
thank you, Chair. No, thanks for the presentation. I'm brand new in this committee, so if I ask something that is out of order because I need to catch up with my reading, you will tell me to. Just a few issues that I wanted to ask. Firstly, I don't know if I'm misunderstanding time, because slide 8, the programs and sub-programs. I don't see one of the issues that you highlighted as very important, waste to energy. I don't see it appearing there, yet you were making an important point that we are just not asking what you can see. Waste. But I'm not seeing that being prioritized, unless it's incorporated under renewable energy and so on. I just need a clarity there. The second issue, this is a state-owned entity, but its funds derive largely from donors. It's worrying because, for a number of reasons, but I'm just going to highlight a few. Firstly, we spend more time applying for money from donors. I worked for an NGO that was entirely independent. It's a helpful report that we have to spend a large part, not just applying on applications, but also reports to all sorts of different people. Secondly, also we know that donor-based funding often affects one's mandate because we are shaped by what donors are prioritizing often, which may or may not be something that we as a country want to prioritize. For an institution as important as this. I also just wanted to know, as the last issue, Chair, and honorable members, oh yeah, by the way, on donors, just on donors, I'm forgetting this. Can you give us an idea, unless I'm out of order, who are some of these donors, for instance? Because I didn't see anything here. And this is contained in another report that I have not had the chance to look at. Lastly, do you have any cooperation, because I guess this sector has got a lot of NGOs in the energy space. The more prominent ones tend to be the ones on nuclear, which we are not dealing with. which I do not understand why, by the way, unless there is an argument that the nuclear requires specific focus. But even if that is the case, you can't be adding to research and not even relate the work that we are doing to issues relating to nuclear process. But are you doing any work with the NGOs? I guess there should be some NGOs that are doing some important work and also work with the communities and so on. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Davis.
Lastly, I'd just like to reiterate what my colleague said about the investigations the chairperson mentioned very glibly. We'd like to know more about this investigation. We'd like to know exactly what is being investigated, who is investigating, and what are the timeframes of the investigation. There are a lot more details which are required today on that investigation.
I would like to welcome the presentation and also congratulate you on your first recording. I would like to question something on the business case for the electricity distribution industry. I would like you to explain what are the terms of reference for the business case, or what does it entail? I would like also to explain the principles and details of the envisioned guide for electricity distribution in the
can we have the detail?
standalone from the integrated plan for the department. Because really, we need to know as to whether this carbon capture will not be in future impact negatively or produce the undesirable consequences which the community will have to suffer from. So I think the risk assessment plan needs to be detailed so that we understand the same way you do.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'd like to start with the air condition. Then I'll come to the chairs. Air condition, if you're not ready, I'm sorry, you will have got to start. Especially to the okay, first, when I'm about to leave, maybe we can get an answer now, but maybe it will not be sufficient. Next week, Tuesday, we have a holding meeting. I have three. Be discussing those which come together with you and your father. Let us that you think are important in this. So I'm sure we expect questions and answers on the process of those two and their conversation in the meeting next week. So we deal with them. I'm asking you to respond. We can take you that to the issues related to the appointment of the chair first. I'm sure the chair will be important. And the investigation. The chair says SSA. Why is this not with the police? So there's something to that. Can you start? With those two. If there are others who want to cover, you can do it. So I'm asking you to start first with the that investigation. I'm sure you know about it. And then the issues related to the chair, the questions related to the chair that you asked.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Chair, I was getting ready to respond to the question. But I just want to maybe start with a question on the IRP to say that the work, we are on track to complete the work that we have to do. And that we, on the modeling side, all the technical work is almost complete. What needs to happen now is the quality adjustment work, which we need to perhaps can expand on next week when we come to the committee. The just as an example of some of the quality work that policy questions that would need to be answered is just to give one example is the issue of the life extension of coal mines. The life extension of coal
life extension.
So those are some of the policy questions that would have to be discussed. But Chair, we will expand on that given an opportunity next week. The maybe if I then respond to the issue of carbon capture and storage, to say that our view, Chair, is that we have an endowment of coal in this country that supports thousands of jobs and will support thousands of those jobs well into the future. and that we need to do something about cleaning the coal. So, in as far as the mandate for Saneli is that they need to look at carbon capture storage, but we also believe that they need to look at clean coal technologies to make sure that we have plans that can remove some of the emissions, for example, desulfurization of the fluids. So those are some of the interventions that we need. And yet, until such time as we are able to develop, in our view, an industrial strategy that can support jobs in the renewable energy sector, that can support manufacturing to a similar extent. And this is something that is going to have to be accelerated going forward. We need to work in that chair with the Department of Trade and Industry. Chair, on the issue of the appointment of the chairperson, there was consultation on the Saneli board by the then minister in 2015 to indicate that the board is coming to an end and that there is a need to reconvene or appoint a new board. The all board appointments, they go through the cabinet process. And for the board appointment to go through, there has to be concurrence by cabinet. And the board of Saneli was not appointed. Now, Chair, I think on the issue of the investigation, Chair, I would like to refer to the chairperson. However, to say that we are aware of an anonymous letter that was sent making a number of allegations. And we were also informed that the matter has been referred for some investigation. I wouldn't want to jeopardize whatever investigation is ongoing. This happened early on this year. Informed of that. But I would really like to defer to the chairperson of the Sunday for this one because perhaps she may have more information than the more up to date.
Yes.
Our view is that Saneli needs to focus quite a lot on energy efficiency as its primary mandate going forward. We have had discussions with the chair and the CEO to really begin to champion energy efficiency and then intervention.
please don't do this next week. Next week, I've been a very good woman for a deeper discussion. Clarity, absolute clarity about where we stand on the world they do. So, diplomacy like this is not going to work. Chair.
Thank you. Through you, Chair. Honourable McCain, who is for time. You've asked a number of questions, and I'm going to start with the IFIS, a case that I mentioned to Colin Crescent. We have had, besides the anonymous letter which came first, the new board was challenged with an anonymous letter which then came from the minister's office requesting for action to be taken. Part of the elements in that anonymous letter included a financial matter that exposed itself then a couple of months later, which falls within the ambit of the financial department. And the matter is indeed with the police, besides it being investigated to see whether the situation was a wonderful situation or not. And it involved an amount of something like 1.5 million, 1.3, 1.2 million that Sanidi is trying to find, and which has disappeared through someone who worked at Sanidi before. Now, we are not able to speak about the matter yet because we haven't received the final report from SSA. Is that correct? Yes. So we are still waiting for the report to understand both the elements of the anonymous letter to see whether there is any substance to it, because the board felt it was important enough to look at that. And the same goes with the financial matter. So, when we do have a report to give, we will take the report and hand it, of course, to the DOE, which will then see it come into this committee. As far as my appointment is concerned, I think that was explained. It goes by cabinet, and it went through its figures and it needed to go, including with my CV. The issues of my personal life, etc., I think you will have to bear with me, Mr. Mackay, because this matter is with the press ombudsman. You will have to wait for the response from the press ombudsman. And there will be more than one case there anyway. Something else that I've missed. If I may, on Matlala, about the...
I would like you to go to the I'm not interested in hearing the details. Just the process. What are you saying about that? The question he posed?
He was asking about my personal life.
Yes, and you.
And I'm saying to Mr. Mackay, because the matter is still with the press ombudsman and it's being taken to court, because of the allegations that are being made.
No, I want to focus on.
Thank you. Thing to go to Honourable about the human resource policies of Sanidi. If I could just explain, the history of Sanidi is like this, that you had CES within which you had Sanidi, and Sanidi itself was made up only of scientists. And these scientists were part and parcel of the Energy Act being amended to include the establishment of Sanidi. Those scientists moved out of CEF and became Sanidi on its own, but they had no policy. So what happened was that Sanidi continued to use the policies of CEF. So whatever issues were ongoing in Sanidi, it would be using those policies. The current board felt that that was not efficient, and it certainly wasn't correct because the size of CEF in comparison to Saneri, as well as the business of the two institutes, were, well, not exactly the same. We also needed to establish a new process of employing people because the board noticed through its investigation how employment took place. So you didn't see natural progression of the advertising of a position, the checking the skills, etc., etc. So we wanted Saneri to have its own policy and to be held accountable for its own policy. And I think that's one of the reasons that we had a few issues with previous audits, if I'm not mistaken, was the fact that we didn't have our own policy. So bringing about the policy now, and not just at speed, but so that it is informed, and that the staff are informed, that's why we actually went about having all these policies put into place, because they are also required. I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to answer all the questions. If I miss any, maybe my colleagues could hand it, but I did want to say to Honourable Mr. Mandi, there is a very fabulous program at Kirkland Primary. I'm not sure whether you are familiar with the school, but the school is in a rural area where it is predominantly surrounded by cows, etc. And what Saneri has done, and I worked with Mr. Mahuma on this, is that the school now is able to cook based on the biogas that is built from the dung of the cows, etc. They can cook for 4 hours a day without using any electricity. And that I think is it's a big step forward for schools that are in rural areas, for example. So the initial outlay for a biogas plant or a biogas element, it might seem large, but when you work it out over, I think it's less than 3 years, it has already made up for its establishment. Yes, donors, they do determine the agenda to a large extent. We have the privilege, I think, in Saneri, I would like to say, because of the chair being brought in with a social justice and transformation focus, rather than whether or not she is a good scientist, I think that has been a positive for Saneri. Because before, and I know that from the scientists this has been confirmed within Saneri, the actual focus on what is happening to the rural poor, to the peri-urban poor, and how are we teaching from the day that the child is growing up, what it actually means when they throw away an apple core, for example. If one has got a bag of about 20 of those, you're already able to bring about gas by starting simple processes of decomposition, for example. And we are also regulated, I think, very much by the Deputy Minister, who herself has been supportive of the chair asking operational staff to draw up a checklist so that we actually see how much of the donor's demand actually meets with the needs of the country. If it is so that there isn't a balance in our favour, then there needs to be a renegotiation, because people won't be supporting without a reason. For example, CCS, we are very heavily supported by the Norwegian state to do CCS, and they have the world's first and largest CCS plant. The tons, I think they were doing something like 950 million tons of gas that was being stored. Am I right? There was 950. That they actually store in this kind of storage system daily. So it's a new idea, and it might seem like it's going to be too much, it might cost too much money. But what we've done is we've taken our policy to go and see a functioning clock. So at the moment I think they're in Canada, or they're about to leave, where they will actually see what will happen and what it actually looks like in real terms. Because people have this idea it might look like a nuclear power plant, it might look like the old water turbine plant, but it doesn't. You hardly see anything on the surface because it's beneath the surface. We are hoping to be able to inspire and convince them, of course, to go along. And the reason why we don't just do it is because we feel that they must give us the input. So that's why we say the donor can say what they would like, but our communities must feel comfortable with it. And we must see, this is not, Saniri doesn't want to go about bringing development in a blackmailing kind of way. It's like, oh, if you let us do this, we'll give you roads, we'll give you this, we'll give you that. People should have roads, they should have homes, as far as we are concerned. And we feel that our painting houses, for example, with paint that either keeps the houses cool or warm them up during winter, that's our way of renewing, making sure that we don't lose renewable energy. The donors, I think our financial person will know better. And NGO work, it's really hard. We do try to work with the NGOs. My concern is that we are not bringing, my personal concern as the chair is that we are not bringing in our young people to educate our scientists, our engineers, so that they are going to take over in the next few years. So that when one of them is sitting here, they've gone through the lived experience of not having affordable energy, and they will have the scientific knowledge to share it. If I've missed anything, please, I
plan to close this session and talk to the board.
But once again, waste to energy number of sectors, say for instance, you've got waste treatment, as I said, landfill, you've got the food security or food production in the industry, whether it's going to be livestock, whether it's going to be plants, there's a number of waste streams that can be beneficiating in the poor for the benefit of our communities. Which are green based. And then some of the waste initiatives that we do are not green based, which are the local community infrastructure, like the chairperson of Sanity mentioned, that in schools we do combine elements of existing waste to produce energy. But let me also say that the element that we haven't worked much on is like a case which is currently on with the Department of Education on the child who fell into a data train and then died. These technologies can actually be used in the same way. Instead of having straight people train, we can harvest the energy from the human waste before those situated the tank. So we're still working in that way to see how other applications can be done in addition to existing technologies that have been offered to grow schools. So I think it's been well covered. On the question of smart grids, on that term, the issue of smart grids is a small element of some of the programs that we initially intended within the extraction process. So to the extent that we are not talking about the Adam process, which is taking a new form and a new approach, smart grids basically use technology focusing not on reconfiguration of existing grids, but more to look at technology to control and information that can be conveyed on existing grids. I think the grid rehabilitation is still going to be a great element of Adam, which should be covered to a large extent by the department. The issue of grid planning, well, the smart grid component basically looks at the future. And when I'm talking about the future, I'm talking the future as in the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years, where the grid as we know today will be completely different. Basically, we're looking at a future where rural areas, IPPs in their diversity and spread will be able to feed into the existing grid and thereby pushing the benefits of economic growth to those rural areas of Southern South Africa. So basically we'll be harnessing every possible energy form to strengthen the grid that we have. That's one part. The other part of course is embedded generation, but also distributed generation, where you don't necessarily have to rely on a plant in Mpumalanga or Kuger in Cape Town, where generation can actually be done for energy can actually be consumed on site. On the relevance of the shelter systems, I would say at this point in time, the whole administrative program is designed with a broader climate change benefit in mind, because it is an incentive which encourages industry in renewable energy forms, in energy efficiency forms, to use less energy as possible. So you also remember, let's recall that we have got target that needs to be met, and this is one of the ways of not only dealing with the energy demand or energy intensity, per unit, but also with climate change and targeted threats that ourselves. On the question of the CO2 production and the risk associated with the communities nearby, the exercise in Norway is not necessarily the same focus for the conservation that we're having in terms of the Committee of Child and Stories, but the principles are the same. Even within the sector, basically you are enhancing the production of the oil market, like using the same technique, basically the carbon dioxide is going back into the world, you know, creating that pressure for you to be able to realize it. But the principle of carbon dioxide, which came from the fossil fuel into the atmosphere, back into, you know, the world again, is the same. So our application is not a big word, mine is not a big word, just get mine to CCS, but it's just a different geological structure that we intend, you know, to use it for, but the principle of having something in the ground has always been there. All the countries where you get the Eastern Bloc or the Middle East has, it is based on the same principle of red is common material which has been kept for millions of years underground. The question of pipelines, yes, the size that has been identified right now will warrant pipelines coming from the areas of high production of CO2. And the business of pipelines, whether it's gas pipelines or pipelines, has always been there. So for me, I'm of the view that South Africa has got the capability of dealing with pipelines, whether it's going to be for liquid fuels, for gases, and other multiple products. Let me stop here for the time that you've given us. Please say that if there are any other issues that you have left out, I think we will then do written submissions to the different stages.
Chair, just regarding a number of answered questions. First and foremost, back to the chairperson of Seneli, I asked specifically who nominated her, what association she has with Sam Spirit Energy, which I would like her to comment on the record in the committee today. I asked her to clarify whether she has current, past, or existing commercial interest in the renewable sector, again, to be put on the record today in front of the committee, to which we have not yet received a response. As to regard to the DG, thank you for illuminating the part of the appointment process, i.e. the cabinet process, but I asked specifically about the entirety of the process. So I asked specifically, was the post advertised? What was the nomination process? Could you please provide us that in writing, documentary proof that it was done? I didn't just ask for the cabinet to approve the board, I asked how was the board approved. So what was the process followed? Could you please detail that process for the committee today, verbally and then again in writing with proof of the actual advertisements for the community, please. Chair, with regard to the comments made by the department on the IRP, we asked specifically will the document be completed by the end of the month. The minister stated on record that it would be due on the 14th. Again, the DG has given us an answer that says he's on track to complete. On track when? Can we have a date, a time, end of November, end of December, end of February? Can we please get a specific when the IRP will be completed and brought forward. Also, the specific question was, will it be made available to this committee? You said that that will be answered next week, but could we please just get that for clarity's sake as well today. Chair, with regard to the DG's comments on carbon storage and our coal endowment, Chair, what we need here is less of quantification around the jobs in the coal sector and more an exact specification of the economic consequences of CCS on the electricity price. Because if the electricity price in South Africa is too high, we lose jobs across all sectors in the economy. So while we might save jobs in the coal sector, that's great, we lose jobs across the entire economy. It's an input cost. We need to know the impact of CCS on the long-term electricity pricing cost of South Africa. I've asked that question ongoing and continuously because, Chair, we actually need to understand what is the economic implication of adopting CCS technology in relation to the broader economy, not just the coal sector, not just coal jobs, but the entirety of the economy. We know that electricity prices are too high, we cannot attract investment in other industries, which means we cannot create jobs. So can we please have an answer to that question, and also when exactly can expect the long-term electricity prices to be made available to the community, so the department can actually show us that it's actually done some work and they're not really pontificating broadly and not based on facts or actual data. Chair, again, I'm also a bit confused. The DG report referred to a consultation process that took place in 2013 around the appropriate appointment of a board. The board was only appointed 12 to 14 months later after the consultation. Perhaps the DG can give us some insight as to why a consultation process to appoint a board took place in 2015, but the board was only appointed in 2016, considering we have serious questions around that process. And then, Chair, also just respond to the investigation. I think Donald Davis's questions were quite clear. We gave the specific answers. Now we have more questions than we do answers. We now have an anonymous letter. There was a reference to the letter arriving on the Minister's office. Was the anonymous letter the same as the letter that arrived on the Minister's office? Which Minister's office was this? Was it TJP? Was it Mrs. Dubai? So maybe, Chair, we can just have a structured answer into exactly what my colleague Mr. Davis asked. We can get some clarity on the specifics around that investigation. But again, why is it the SSA as well as the police? It just raises more red flags and it's deeply concerning. So Chair, we just need specific answers to specific questions and not broad quantifications around the question that we most often. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr.
No, thanks, Chair. I think that I'm covered because you had also raised this question. I'm worried about state security agencies doing work that is not appropriate. I know we are not the right community. I thought that maybe we need clarity on this, but I'm not bringing you Chair or anything like that, but you might know better. Why is the state security agency poking its noses on matters that actually do not belong to them, like in this instance? Because this matter is very serious. If indeed there are things like this that are happening, then this thing may have to be raised with the committee, amongst others, you know, or even the Inspector General. I just wanted that to at least we get it, and I'm really worried, Chair. I'm really very worried about this mess.
I'm worried now that we will not get Thank you. We'll have to return to this. I don't know who 18 DG. Level of performance that you have, we will not finish. And I think this thing was directed to you last time, where the DG, where the accounting office. Don't give us political speeches, answer questions. The DRM and the minister on the idea, they can give us political speeches. We shouldn't do that. I don't know this thing about basic meetings. I find it very strange. Even if you are to do, if you are to be intelligent, what to be done, there's intelligence, you need the police to do that. Why is this matter of 1.5 million with state security? Okay. But there are other questions as well. I wanted to close this matter, but you hear that the members would want some clarification on some specific questions that are pressing. Can you do those quick in the next 8 minutes and close those? So that we can move to the next presentation.
Yes, Chief. In the declaration made to the Department of Energy, Mr. McCann would have seen that any interests of mine are registered in there. It's on record, it's therefore public record. Sandspur Energy is actually Luxury, which is a PTY limited company, trading as Sandspur Energy. Do I have any interest in any energy efficiency related businesses, etc.? I have to say no. Then when it comes to why the FSA, it was because the former CEO of Sandini called in the FSA. He didn't call in the police first, he called in the FSA and came to tell the board after he had done this. Was there anything else, Mr. Kani and Mr. Davis?
Don't ask one of our members. I'm chairing the meeting. Okay. There are questions that are now related. I'm now trying to make a decision in my mind. It appears that the DG will be able to get Sanedi here in the street, because we're going to ask you to bring several other people from the entities, because they are now related matters, electricity pricing, the issue of CTS, the issues of what we do with research, the things we're going to be dealing with in the next week, participation in the RFP, so all of that we're dealing with in the next week. Now I'm thinking that we may have to attend here, but we'll do that in the next week. Do you want to say anything before I give to the honourable members? I must apologize. I know that.
Thank you, Chair. The Chair, just a quick point to say that in as far as UK energy is concerned, we need a specific, I think the question asked by there is a specific research and development state-owned company that deals with the research. That is next to South African Nuclear Energy Corporation. So when the Energy Act was promulgated, Sanedi was trying to focus on all the other energies with the exception of the nuclear energy, which already had its own. Just to say, Chair, maybe quickly on the issue of the without perhaps diverging too much, to say that the appears that the individual was very weak why they had to be, you know, in their investigation. It looked like he had done this kind of thing in other institutions. So they had to be more in depth in investigation as to how far they are.
Doesn't matter how long how far the investigation goes and whether it's the force of intelligence. It's police work. That's why they have this kind of intelligence to follow up those problems that still have been complicated things. But they are not energy matters. They belong somewhere else. I'm just saying, I think we just I thought we were going to have a short presentation, but just an experience of very short presentation. Now it appears there are issues. We may have to come back to have more discussions with friends. But for now, thanks very much for your presentation. And then our sister is ready for the next presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
as an introduction, we go back to our definition of the regulator. We are a schedule of 3A entity, which is established in terms of the National Media Regulator Act of 1999. And our mandate is to provide for the protection of persons, property, and environment against the nuclear damage through the establishment of safety standards and regulatory practices. We regulate facilities that include power reactors at Kuwait, research reactor at NEXA, nuclear technology applications, which is found also in NEXA and other places, radioactive waste management complex in the North Kingdom. Mining and mineral processing facilities, use of small quantities of radioactive waste materials, transport of radioactive materials, as well as the regulation of vessels propelled by nuclear power or those that use nuclear materials. Chair, are we?
No, it's because you already from. I'm told that. No, let's do this. In fact, I prefer it. It's quite short and semi-nude. That is what you have. The latest regulation to us. Can you use that? As long, just tell us you are on this case. We can bring the copy.
Right, so let's jump to page 3. So looking at the trends, performance trends, you have that?
Yes, from 10 page 5.
Yeah, but page 3 is key function. And then performance trends, you see that, yeah, we are there.
Okay. If you look at the performance trend over the years from 2012 to date, we see an upward trajectory in terms of performance of the organization. It needs to be explained that right at the beginning of every year, the board sets targets for performance and say, as a minimum, you will achieve 80%. And this is precisely to, as an organization, not as individuals, this is precisely to take into consideration extremist measures that may have arisen during the reporting period, because we can always type it 100%, but there may be other things. So the board would say, at the minimum, organizational performance shall be 80% or more. So if you look at 2012-2013, we still had baseline at 80%, and we performed at 81, then 82 in 2013-14, and then we realized at that time that we needed to up the threshold and propose to the board that we think we need to be up to 85 in line with our pledge for culture of high performance. And we put at 85 and performed at 90. Subsequently, from 91 to 92, and the period of the review, we are at 90%, which is still ahead, way up from the 85% target. So in all, we paint the picture of an organization that has espoused a culture of high performance. On the highlights, Chairperson, as an organization, one of the mandates that we entrusted, we together now on that slide.
The bus company.
All right.
It is not your fault. We are under pressure, you understand. So
pressure control issue. All right. So we looking at the highlights for the period under review. As I said, one of our mandates as the organization is to be the country's focal point on issues that has got that concerns international obligations towards nuclear safety and security. So we have successfully completed and submitted our seventh report of the Convention on Nuclear Safety to the IAEA. We presented it and we were appraised by our international colleagues on our continued efforts to achieve the objectives of the convention. We also undertook significant international engagement and we have worked closely with organizations such as the International Nuclear Energy Agency as well as the International Commission on Radiation Protection, the ICRP. As a matter of fact, we hosted the International Conference of the International Radiation Protection Agency Conference, the IRPA, in March 2016 here in Cape Town. For the period under review, we also, in conjunction with the Department of Energy and Department of Health, successfully hosted the 11th day integrated review service mission in South Africa by the IAEA. Now, this mission is aimed to assess the regulatory framework for nuclear and radiation safety in South Africa. It's a very intensive process. It is a rigorous peer review process, which has been conducted over many countries over the world that are member states. Having worked for the IAEA myself, I know very well that the outcomes of these kinds of missions means a lot for a country, because it begins to say that this is a mirror through which you must look at yourself and begin to deal with the blemishes that you see in your face. Now, this mission in particular was one of the highest attended missions in the history of the IAEA, where we had 27 members. Normally, the average number of experts sent per country is 20, but we had 27 members in that team, comprised of experts from Argentina, Austria, Belgium, and a lot more countries. And it was led by Mr. McCree from the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now the outcomes of that, as we now know, we've seen it in press conferences, we've seen it in press releases, we've seen it in newspapers, it unequivocally projected South Africa and the National Nuclear Regulator in particular to be firmly in control of its mandate of protecting property, people and the environment against radiation damage. Also that we have a team, we have processes that are in line and in sync with the international safety standards. Because this is done as measured against IAEA safety standards. During the period of the review, we collected 152 million authorization fees. As the members would know, we derive our revenue from two streams, which is the grants and the authorization fees, or we can call it license fees from the operators. This time around, we collected about 10% more than the previous year from the authorization fee, and the state grant that was given was for 1 million, which included 24 million cash flow, which was provided in the interim for processing of ESCOM nuclear installation site license application, which was launched in May 2016. This amount will be covered from the annual budgets by the DOE in 2019 through the reduction of our baseline allocation for the new financial year. As I said earlier, we achieved 90 against the research target 55 performance rating. We also have, as a highlight, progressed our developmental work for integrated management system in line again with the International Atomic Energy Agency's safety standards and requirements, and we will be implementing it in full in the new financial year. I must say, Chairperson, that the IRRS report, the International Integrated Regulatory Review report that the IAEA conducted, we have requested the DOE we have recommended to the DOE to make it public so that we indeed gravitate towards the transparent regulator. Now, as you would know, this is a process that squarely belongs to the country, so it is up to government to decide to make it public. But we have recommended that it be made public. We also achieved a milestone of launching our first Center of Excellence for Nuclear Safety and Security in South Africa on the 16th of September, which is co-hosted by the University of Pretoria and the Hendrix campus. Now, the CNSS is an initiative by the regulator, realizing that South Africa is very thin on skills, first and foremost, and secondly, that our country only has one nuclear engineering school in the whole country, which is the University of Northwest, which is Northwest University in Portugal. Now, we decided that the regulator in particular needs to harness and actually grow its own timber to ensure that we catch them young, as they say, to ensure that we get the students fresh from undergraduate into the graduate system to begin to school them into a mentality of regulating nuclear safety. It is one thing to be able to perform as an operator of nuclear services, but also to regulate is a different story because you need to first get in touch with the philosophy of regulation. So that is why we have started this initiative. It is a multi-stakeholder initiative in such in the sense that you have the university as the host, and you have other spokes, which are another 7 universities in South Africa, and we have 2 more universities from the United States, and we have the Center for High Performance Computing of the CSIR as all the partners in the Center for Nuclear Safety and Security. When we present this, we always say it stands on 3 legs, namely education and training, research and development, and consultant, technical support and consultant services on the areas of nuclear safety. We continue to review the nuclear installation safety license, nuclear installation site license applications from State Tasman and Dana Fontaine, as the committee will recall, ESCOM submitted these last year, March, and we are continuing with the reviews of this. In particular, Tasman was prioritized, and therefore, our work so far has been on the Tasman site. As you would know and have seen from the press release of the Department of Environmental Affairs, the picture has now changed. The site that has been prioritized has been the Dana-Fontaine site, Now, we also, on the same press, must realize that there was no filter flow found as per the report by the DEA. There was no filter flow found on the Tasman site, which means that ESCOM, if they so decide, they can go back and resuscitate that application. We will therefore, given the direction by ESCOM, proceed also to do the work on the Dana-Fontaine site. The establishment of the South African National Dose Register has one line now, which uses the system raised from the IAEA, and we have had it has been one of our considerable milestones in the reporting period. We also, as part of our regulatory mandate, have to reach out to communities to inform them about our work and to inform them about the risks, of course, of nuclear. And to that extent, we launched our first nuclear regulatory information conference, which was coined a huge success by all stakeholders. The conference attracted participants from local and international organizations and served as a valuable platform for sharing experiences and discussing ideas and exchanging information. By popular demand, this conference has now been deemed to be a necessary event on a biennial basis. In other words, we invite the committee to our next, to our second regulatory information conference in May 2015. The NNR continued to support multilateral nuclear safety cooperation through participation in the regulatory cooperation forum of the IAEA, which we currently are the chairman of. And we also are a member of the multinational design evaluation program and the forum of ministerial regulatory bodies in Africa, which we are currently the deputy chairperson of. The NNR hosted regional nuclear safety and security training workshops in conjunction with the IAEA and the European Commission, which has provided tremendous in-kind contribution towards our capacity building efforts. Over the reporting period, we have also looked at. This includes the delayed appointment of the board. As you would remember, Chairperson and forum members, the term of the board of the previous board ended in December 2015, from which point the board, the term was extended for a shorter period and continued for over the year until the new board was appointed on the 7th of December. Obviously, this caused a lot of discomfort on the side of management and also equally on the side of the board members themselves, because they not only did this piecemeal extension affect the planning of their professional life, as they also have a life outside the boardship of the IAEA, but also they deemed it to be the governance risks in as far as the decisions they are taking on an ad hoc board membership basis. The late approval of the authorization fees continues to be one of those problems that we experience almost every year as the NNR, and that causes a lot of problems in our planning. Just to illustrate, last year our authorization, we normally inform the department about our proposal for increasing authorization fees given a certain percentage. And for the current financial year, we informed the department in February about our plans, and only did we get the approval just 4 weeks ago. Now that creates a lot of problems for us, because then we have to work on an assumed budget until we get certainty from the department, and noting of course that the department, the minister in particular, has to do this in conjunction and in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. So that back and forth between the ministries sometimes, most of the time, is delayed, and that affects our planning. We also have a challenge in the finalization of the amendment to the Act, which we think holds a very important update that would help us strengthen our regulatory framework in the country. The process of reviewing the NNR regulations in line with the revised Act is crucial for ensuring regulatory effectiveness in line with international trends and best practices. Again, as we know, this process is governed by not only the department, but also by the legislative, by the National Assembly processes, and therefore we would hopefully request the committee to, when this comes to their table, to give it priority so that we continue the good work that we're doing in making sure that South Africa is safe from any undue harm likely to come. Another challenge, Chairperson, is the harmonization of the regulation of radioactive sources. In this country, we have a peculiar situation where we have two regulatory authorities in as far as radiation is concerned. We have the National Nuclear Regulator, which is responsible for things I mentioned earlier, but in parallel to that, we have the Department of Health, Directorate for Radiation Control, which regulates radioactive sources mostly in the medical practices. And a number of international missions and peer review missions have actually flagged this as a risk and have recommended that these be amalgamated into one entity. And we have led to report that the process to get the Directorate of Radiation Control under the NNR is currently moving in concurrence with the support of the Minister of Health. Next, on the nuclear authorizations that are active for the period, Chairperson, I'm not going to list them. You can see we have a number of those in the first slide. The biggest one, as you expect, is the Quebec Nuclear Power Station. And as you go down on that slide, you see a lot of facilities that will regulate the Penny Lava site next And then on the next slide, you see a number of, still again, number of nuclear installation licenses that are still under NEXA currently. And these include the Falkbridge facility, which is closer to Springbok in the Northern Cape. Next, we look at the occupational exposure to radiation at the Quebec Nuclear Power Station. We must note that on your left is the mini-civil, which is the unit for radiation exposure, and on the other axis of the reporting period. Now you can see that in 2015 you had a high dose, but you must remember that the maximum dose per occupational dose per worker is 20 millisieverts, which means even though in 2015 we had 0.7 millisieverts, you basically just a drop in the ocean, you are far from exceeding. But despite that, we see on 2015, obviously can be explained by the fact that that is the period when ESCOM had an outage. Now during an outage, you open up the reactor, and this is the maintenance period, and more work gets run into the power plant, and people get exposed more. They spend more time because they work overtime for the outage process. But we are glad to report that there are no serious occupational exposures, as you can see from the graphs. The same applies for NEXA in 2016. You see the spike in 2016 for NEXA. Now, that is something that we need to talk about and to inform the committee. That in 2016, NEXA had an incident. As you can see, we had a big spike there of about close to 70 millisieverts. NEXA had an incident of an exposed worker who was doing work for NEXA in Brazil. NEXA has an international project that they do to help other countries to clean up their often radioactive sources, disused radioactive sources, which is a very internationally acclaimed technology that was started here in South Africa many years ago. However, we had an accident of that nature in Brazil, which obviously, as you can imagine, is not under the NNR's jurisdiction, but given the fact that NEXA is our regulated entity, they had to report it to us, and when we add it to the dose for the year, it spikes the numbers, as you can see. On the next slide, you have special case mines. Now, these are the mines that why are they called special case? Because they are significant mines. These are mines that have shown to have predisposed risk of exceeding radioactive levels, exposure levels. So we give them a special dispensation in as far as regulation is concerned under a special enforcement regime, and we report on them every year. As you can see from the graph there, they are not so much concerns. We are still keeping them on check. One of the biggest mines there, as you can see, is the Red Uranium mine, which has got more than 4,000 workers. At this point, I will yield to the chairman, to the finance director, the CFO, to take us through the statement of financial position.
Thank you, CFO, and good afternoon to the chair, and good afternoon to the honorable member. Going into the next slide, chairperson, which just an analytics of our financial position, which is our balance sheet. You see the chair on the maroon color, or the maroon line, that our non-current assets, which mainly relate to our building, has not had any unusual move. It is just a normal reduction of non-current assets through depreciation. So you see that of the trend over the past five financial years, it has moved from 190 million and is now sitting at 170 million. And then on the greenish line is our intangible assets, which are as well range bound. These are mainly related to our computer software related expenses, and it has moved from 1.9 million, and now you're sitting at 159,000. If you go to the next statement, which is our the next slide, which talks still about our balance sheet, but on the current asset side, you see that the maroon line here on the previous financial year it did have a spike a bit from 3 million, it shot up to 94 million. And these were mainly due to what the CEO has been lamenting to, which is the late gazetting of authorization fees. What this does is that by the time, so when the authorization fees are not gazetted in time, we use the previous year rate. And as and when the gazette is done, then we issue a follow-up invoice to invoice the amount that is outstanding. But then that what creates that if it gazetted too late, then all the invoices we have issued for that financial year then remain debtor or remain unpaid at the end of the financial year. And therefore, that is what the CFO was emphasizing in terms of that it does affect our planning. In that very same slide, we have got our cash and cash equivalents as well. You see that our cash and cash equivalent has a bit of unusual spike. That was mainly due to an expense capital project that we were doing. In the past 3 years, we have done our regulatory emergency control center. So in that center, that's where we are able to detect activities of regular activity in all new plant operations. So for instance, while we are sitting in Pretoria, we can be able to detect when it's fully functional, we'll be able to detect what is happening on the environment in Cape Town side, Quebec, and then we'll be able to see what is happening in Safari in Nexa while it is in our office. So this project is almost complete now, it's undergoing commissioning. As a result, you can see the cash there that we were keeping going down. And again, we had a laboratory that we were doing. In the past, we used to use for samples that we collect from nuclear installations and sites, we will use a private laboratory to test samples that we collect. Now, that had a bit of a challenge because it has everything to do with our independence. And at times, we used to use the Nexa lab as well. Now we have completed our own laboratory, and now it's functional. At this current moment, we are able to cover about over 50% of our sample, and then we are extending the scope, and we are hoping that by the next financial year or so, we'll be covering 100%. If we go to the next slide, which talks about the non-current liabilities, the straight line that seems to be going down here relates to our bond for the office that we have, for our headquarters office, which we have purchased. So the line represents the pay down of our bond. We anticipate to complete paying up that building in the next 5 years. And then the green line, which talks about unspent conditional grant, is related to the capital expenditures that I was talking about. So the more we finalize the project for which we have funding specifically allocated for that, and that amount goes down. What remains there, which is about 15 million, relates to the office that we are working on refurbishing here in Cape Town, which is the office that serves the Quebec Nuclear Power Station. Now, on that project, we are working hard to secure approval by the Cape Town Council. And for the past about 8 months, we have been struggling with that process. But up to this moment, there are a number of questions that have been referred back to us, particularly which relates to the zoning of our office, because the approval then must take into consideration that building is within the 5 kilometer radius from the nuclear power station, which have got a restriction in terms of how far can it expand. And therefore, that is one hurdle that we are still working on to resolve. Otherwise, here, the other purple line, which is our employee benefit obligation, this relates to the old order defined benefit schemes that we have. Currently, we have got 3 active members or employees that we still contribute and provide for. For that defined benefit obligation, and we have got about 80 pensioners that are on the scheme. So the organization continues to service that liability. You will remember that in terms of that order and the employer used to carry the burden of provision for a retirement liabilities for life. So we are still setting that liability until our obligations are fully met. If we go to the next slide, which is our current liabilities check, this is just straightforward. It's not. It's more of our operational transaction. So from time to time, they will go up and down. But maybe what is worth noting there is the 25%, 28% increase on payables, which mainly relates to the Kruger nuclear power plant in generator replacement project. Now what happens in that project is that because we have got permanent employees that we have appointed that are allocated to that particular project, in our budgeting process there is allocation that is made. But activities such as inspection, which are happening all over the world, as you will understand, it's about four countries when the manufacturing, the instrumentation, and the automation of the entire system is being done, we send inspectors at particular points for inspection. Now, ESCOM, in terms of our agreement, they advance money so that we're able to do those activities, and then at the end of the financial year, then we'll reconcile those activities, and if there's additional funding that is to be provided, it is provided, or if there's a refund that is to be done, we then reconcile. And therefore, that is what that 28% talks about. So if we go to slide 22, which is our financial performance of income statement, the CEO has already talked about the blue line, which is the operating fees. Maybe I can only talk to the government grants maroon line, which again talks to the special allocation. You will see that our government grant have been going down to about 21 million in 2016, and then it shot up to about 40 in 2017. But that shot up share was not really an allocation, a grant per se. It was what the CEO was referring to, talking about the cash flow provision for the state bank and the Quebec side for the nuclear installation site license application. So we went to Treasury and say that our model of financing is that it's on recovery. So we do work and then we invoice. So we went to Treasury and say that we need a kind of a bridge finance to allow us to have cash flow to fund the activities in advance, and then we'll invoice the costs when we are as and when we progress. So now the process is advanced, and therefore we no longer have that cash flow problem to face, and in the next financial year we will return back the funds to the fiscus through the reduction of our state account. The next slide, which is the expenses check, there is really nothing out of ordinary. Our goods and services have decreased by about 8%. In the main, the austerity measures that the Treasury has applied have affected us as well. So we have to reduce some of our expenses. This is problematic, Chair, because what suffered most in this process is mainly our training and development. And this is very important. If we're looking at the trajectory of growth in the nuclear industry, we need to continuously equip and develop our own timber and again, you know, strengthen those that are in the system to keep updated with the international trends in this field. The last slide, Chair, on the financial side, which is the creditors' payment and around time. We have, with all the what the honourables have been talking about here in Parliament about that we need to be able to pay our service providers in time. At least in our case, we are now able to pay our service providers within 4 days of presentation of the valid invoice. This is
activity that we watch closely, and we have prioritized it in our planning and eventual implementation. And we think now we need to be able to maintain this four day turnaround time. I think it's quite reasonable, and then our service providers will not suffer out of us not being able to service our debt to them. The chair of the audit committee has requested me to continue with this slide, and as my boss, I accepted the delegation. So going to the audit outcome of 2016-17, which is slide number 25, we have obtained our first successive clean audit report for the period under review, and for that we will want to laud the good work that our audit committee and our internal audit do in terms of keeping asset management in check and ensuring that all the controls are in check all times. The work of our audit committee, of course, our audit committee is a structure that is created in terms of the PFMA, and then it has members that are non-executive board of directors. And amongst others, we have the chairperson here, who is in charge of that particular committee, who is the chartered accountant. Chair, on the revised presentation, we have corrected the statement of certified internal auditor, so it has to be removed. It must be put on record that the chairperson is a CA, and he's an independent non-executive director, and not a certified internal auditor. The committee chair usually, or its scope, covers ICT, controls, risk management, finance, audit, environmental, and nuclear science. The chair is taking this.
Chair, the role, I need to introduce the chair of this committee. What do you want to say about challenges?
The first challenge is the one that Sanedi also put across. I suppose all state-owned entities have the same problem, but it becomes a bigger problem for smaller organizations such as ours with a very big mandate when you have the government grants reducing all the time. And of course, the lower threshold of approval of transition fees. Because if we, one would expect that in the normal course of things, if government says to reduce the grant, they give you the latitude to at least recover the percentage, that the reduction percentage from the license fees. But still, again, that is not the case. So we end up always working on a shortfall, which makes life quite difficult for us to reach the level of mature regulator that we want, world-class regulator that we want to be. We have also highlighted the challenge on the regulation of the resources, which is really part of health, and we firmly and hopefully on the right path to get that reined in and consolidated to consolidate the regulatory framework. The low staff capacity to regulate aging installations. This is an international problem. The installations, new installations are aging, and as they age, they come with quite a number of interesting material science issues, for example. And this requires a lot of in-depth analysis to inform regulatory approaches. And unfortunately, we have a low capacity to be able to do that, and as a result, we have to rely on our international bilateral partners to assist with inputs where needed. So we need to build up that area, and we are not ashamed to say in front of the committee that is one of our handicaps that we are working very hard to address, partly through the Center for Nuclear Safety and Security, which we hope will begin to bear fruit in the next 3 to 5 years. And finally, which another problem that we face is ineffective cooperation agreements with other state organs. Now, the constitution of our country joins state entities and departments to enter into cooperative agreements to ensure that we are able to cooperate on issues where mandates may seem to be overlapping, so that there are no gray areas that things fall through the cracks. And we, for example, in this area have overlapping mandates with the Department of Mineral Resources, for example, when we regulate the mines, they also are the chief mine inspectors, the office of chief mine inspectors. We also have environmental regulation overlap with the Department of Environmental Affairs, the rail safety regulator, and so on. We also have to license the transportation of radioactive materials. Now, if you don't work together with the state agencies, there are problems that occur, and these problems ultimately fall on the plate of the regulator. Take a case in point for the much talked about exposure, an informal settlement near the mining dump in Mohali City. This is a cocktail problem. But ultimately, if people go and settle forming for informal settlements closer to these mining dumps, which are radioactive, it is not the NNR's duty to fence off those people and get them out of their place. But it is the NNR's duty to flag the dangers of having people settling closer to disused mines which may be radioactive. But then other state organs must step in to relocate these people. For example, COMTA must do that. For example, the municipality in Mohali must also assist. So those intergovernmental agreements do not seem to be working. Cooperative agreements are not working very well as we expect, and that was the problem for the regulator. In particular, reputational damage as far as that is concerned. Because when people go to the papers, they fail to point out that this infrastructure is supposed to be a cooperative issue. It is only points to the NNR having failed in executing its mandate. So that is another issue that we'd like to flag coming in Chairperson. I think we've done our best to save the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
my suggestion is we should close the response and reserve our questions for next week Tuesday. The time is now 1 o'clock. And then sorry for rushing you. We commend you for your team audit, and we know it's not for the first time. So we've been talking to the FTDC to find out why is NERSA and NNR, who are regulators, seeking team audit and not the other entities. So when we come back to the capacity of the DOE in overseeing these entities, we definitely at this point, thanks on our members. We'll see you next Tuesday at 10 o'clock. E249. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, of course.